The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Trade talks with China are back on, supposedly. Tesla is slammed as the SEC is looking into fraud allegations. Consumer sentiment dips, but still in solid territory. And listener questions are answered. All this and much more on episode number 575 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a good day to you. Yeah, I'm back. It's Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. And yeah, I'm back. A couple of weeks. Just 1 week I missed of the podcast, but I'm back to my vacay. I was over in Asia, went to South Korea, went to China. What a, just a marvelous experience. If you hadn't had the opportunity to get over to Asia in general, I really encourage you to do so. Just an amazing, amazing area to visit. I can't say anything negative about it. I mean, there's some negatives. There's some places that I'd be like, I'm not going back there. But generally speaking, I got to tell you something, just a great experience when it comes to the opportunity to see a totally different culture than we experience here. So in South Korea, I spent time, I went to the barbecues, of course. If you haven't, that's another thing. If you haven't had a true and traditional South Korean or Korean barbecue where you cook the food at the table on your own, you got to do this. With some beer and some soju. Karaoke is great. You have private karaoke rooms. And they call that Norabang over there. But, you know, here it's kind of like karaoke. You get in front of a group. And everybody's watching you. And you're singing. You're doing your thing. Over there, it's all private. You get a private room. And the sound system, the speakers, the lights, the disco balls, the lasers in this room that's maybe, I'll call it 12 by 12, maybe a little bit bigger, 14 by 14. I'll give you a 14 by 14 room with a couch. They bring you snacks. They bring you beers. They bring you drinks, whatever you want. You get a few microphones. You get this incredibly thick songbook, maybe about 6 or 8 inches thick. Of course, there are other languages that you could choose from, but you know, even the English section is incredibly thick. And you just pay $20 an hour to have fun. Great, great, great experience. Went on some food tours, cooking classes, did some sightseeing, of course. And then from Seoul, I went over to Jeju Island. And that's a little island off of the coast of about an hour plane ride from Seoul. And I spent a couple of days there just enjoying the area and sightseeing, etc. Then over to Shanghai, China to end the trip. Now, a couple observations that I thought maybe you'd be interested in from Korea in particular and Seoul. We'll start with Seoul. So what I found was it was really interesting was there was this combination yet separate nature of the old and the new sitting right on top of each other. Sometimes hard to distinguish where one ends and where one starts. And sometimes very easy to distinguish, kind of looking at, okay, that neighborhood clearly is an old traditional neighborhood, hasn't really been changed for hundreds of years, maybe even longer, who knows. And then you look to your left and all of a sudden you see these incredibly large buildings and skyscrapers and very new malls. It is very clear, though, that the new is taking over. Crowding out, I would say, much of the old and main city that was there prior. Now, on the outskirts of Seoul, still an amazing amount of tradition and old-style Korean housing and the streets, markets that are still intact. So that was really great to see as well. Now, I found that the Korean, I found the Korean barbecue place that Anthony Bourdain had gone to on his South Korean episode. It was absolutely fantastic. It wasn't fancy. As a matter of fact, I would say it was less than fancy. We got there in the afternoon about 2 o'clock. They were just trimming up a bunch of meat. Meat trimmings were all over the floor of the restaurant. We sat down. They served us just an amazing meal, one of the best Korean barbecues. I don't know what they did exactly different than the other ones, but it was fantastic. Maybe it was just me. Maybe I was just excited that I was spending some time and paying homage and tribute to Anthony Bourdain when I was there and having somewhat of a, I mean, I really love the guy. I thought he was just an amazing influence on my travels. So being at the place that he was at and experience what he experienced was really special. Now, Jeju Island, I may have been, my group, we were four of us, possibly the only Americans on the entire island. It was a gorgeous place for rest, relaxation. You know, this is the place that many Koreans go to for their summer vacation with their families. They go to the hotels of Jeju Island. They also do a lot of honeymooning and marriages there. It's Lover's Island. Great place, beautiful. And then on Shanghai, when I hit that on the back end of the trip, it's possible that this was the nicest hotel I've ever been to in anywhere in the world. The Waldorf Astoria Shanghai. Fantastic. From the room that was a suite. It was an upgraded suite. And it was four rooms. Gigantic bathroom with heated marble floors. It was two bathrooms actually in the suite. There's a sitting area. There was an office area. There was a canopy bed, beautiful bedroom, two closets. Wow. Beautiful. The long bar there, the dining area downstairs was gigantic. The chandeliers, just the entire experience of this hotel was top notch. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous hotel. Left nothing to speculate how it could get better. I also visited the Jewish area. I don't know if you know about this, but there's a Jewish area in Shanghai, something called the, quote, Shanghai Jews. These were Jews that were a group of Jews, about, I think it was upwards of 40 to 50,000 Jews, had been forced out of various areas due to their concern over what was going on leading up to World War II and what was happening in Nazi Germany and the anti-Semitism that was happening around the world. And they landed in Shanghai. And there was a whole area that they occupied in there. There was a ghetto that was created also by the Japanese, an internment area that was created during World War II as Japan was occupying South Korea. But still, there was a remaining temple there and a history and a museum. Really an interesting story, what's going on. The Shanghai Jews. I think there's a book or a movie or a documentary called The Shanghai Jews, which I encourage you to take a look at. I haven't seen that one, but I was told it was there. And just to understand the historical significance of this area, there's not many that are living there any longer. Once Israel was created and there was other areas that they could go to, they decided to leave. But they definitely left their imprint on the area, in particular this particular region in Shanghai. I also did a lot of touring and eating. Like I said, same thing in Seoul. Went to a variety of nighttime markets and pub crawls and dining experiences and eating throughout the streets. One of the things that I did in Shanghai was I had the opportunity with this little guide group that we had. They said, well, do you want to try something interesting? I'm like, well, okay. Yeah, all right. So we walked down the street and they said, some people really, really love it and some people really hate this. I'm like, well, what could this be? It's called fried fermented tofu. So the fermented part threw me a little bit, but we've been eating kimchi throughout the whole week. That's fermented cabbage, essentially. So I said, all right, we'll try it. So we get there and they take these squares, these black pieces of tofu, which is obviously moldy fermented tofu, and they stick it in a vat of oil. And I got to tell you something. The smell that came off of there was god-awful. It was one of those smells that, honestly, you want to, you could gag from. It's so awful. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe it tastes better than it smells. Maybe. I don't know, it's possible. Why would she bring me to something to eat that is so terrible, aside from the experience? So I watched it get fried, and then they put it in a cup, all these different pieces of tofu, maybe an inch by an inch, about 10 of them in a cup. They poke a hole in the top. It kind of deflates a little bit from the frying. Inside of it, they put chili peppers and oil and sesame oil and just a variety of different spices, top it off with some scallions, and hand it to you with long toothpicks in this cup. Okay, here we go. I take it. I put it up to my nose. The smell is just, it's indescribable. Just indescribable how awful this smells. I figure maybe like durian fruit, maybe it tastes better. I don't know. Maybe we'll try it here. So anyway, I tasted it. I ate about a quarter of it. And I must tell you, the taste exactly matched the smell. It was horrible. Something that I don't know who could like it. My buddy, he took a bite of about half of it. And that was it. We were done. We couldn't. By the way, if you know me, I eat a lot of strange things. I eat pretty much, you know, anything. And usually I like it. You know, it's sometimes a little bit tough to get into something, but okay. And usually I'm like, okay. You know, crickets, I'll eat it. Man, they were good. They were tasty. They were fine. I don't know if I'm going to make it a steady diet. But this fermented fried tofu, oh, if you don't have it, don't try it. It's really not necessary. I mean, maybe you like it. If you do like it, maybe you have different taste buds. I gave the rest of it to the tour guide. I said, do you want the rest of this? Oh, yes. My sister and I will enjoy this later. Put a cap on it, covered it, and that was it with there. But it was a great trip overall. It rounded out my Asian experience, where I've been to China and Japan and Myanmar, Cambodia, where else? Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand. I think looking back on all this, it's possible that Vietnam was the favorite place, my favorite place that I've ever been to in Asia. So I don't know if we're going to be doing that next year. I'm thinking about going to South Africa. I have some friends down in South Africa that own a very large vineyard. And they told me I can come down and work on the vineyard for a couple of days. And if the timing's right, I can get involved in the wine stomp, the grape stomp, and then make my own wine. So I don't know, maybe I'll do that. We'll see. Anyway, I'm back. Let's talk markets for a moment and look back on last week, because there was some crazy stuff. There was some funkiness in the markets last week, over the last, you know, 10 days, let's say. And I think the two key drivers clearly over the last week that moved markets and created volatility. We saw that spike of the VIX in particular, and the movement of the markets. Clearly, we have to say that Turkey was the first part of the week that really caused a lot of investors to get unnerved. The continuation of the saga where, I mean, Turkey's lira dropped somewhere like 30% over the first few days of the week. 80% since the beginning of the year. That's a lot for a currency. Any currency, that's a lot to move in a period of 8 months or even 20% or 30% in a matter of 10 days. That's tremendous. That causes havoc to a market. It causes an immense amount of stress on central banks, on consumers, on the bonds, on banks, and not only on the banks from within Turkey, but think about the stress that puts on financial institutions around the world that are trying to clear funds on a regular basis in Turkish lira compared to whatever other currency that they're dealing with. I mean, that's a real problem. A lot of money can be lost or frankly made with that kind of move. But the Turkish lira dropped, and that's due to the sanctions and these tariffs and more threats against Turkey if they don't return the imprisoned pastor. And it doesn't look like that the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, the White House, anybody in the U.S. is really looking to lift those sanctions unless we get a return of this pastor. Now, of course, the other side is saying, well, this is not just a pastor. This is not just a nice fellow that's a God-fearing, loving minister of faith. And this is a spy. This is a terrorist. Now, whatever the story is, the problem is both sides are digging in their heels. And it doesn't look like we're going to see a very quick resolution here. Now, Turkey clearly in this scenario is the loser so far. I mean, there's no question about that. But the real question you have to ask is, well, what is that going to mean elsewhere? How is that going to play out? Why is this important anyway? What do we care about Turkey? Who cares? It's Turkey. We don't do a lot of trade with them. We do some. But, you know, they're still a pretty reasonable size economy. But the real importance here is not necessarily simply about what happened due to the fact that the sanctions on Turkey due to this was something that was been going on for a while already. You take out this last week of what's going on, Turkish lira is still down 40%. And that's just since the beginning of this year. And this is not an isolated incident when it comes to currencies right now. And this is where the importance lies. We have this U.S. dollar strength and a lack of liquidity due to the fact that the Fed is pulling back and the ECB talks about pulling back and Japan is talking about changing what they're doing. There is a concerted effort to pull back on the quantitative easing and the easy money around the world. And that is why this is important. Because for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And what happened is over time, when there was really easy money policy, there was a lot of bonds issued, specifically dollar-denominated bonds from companies and countries around the world. And it was easy money because, you know, you can get, hey, I can get dollar-denominated bonds of a Turkish company for 8-9%. Hey, in the search for yield and the reach for yield, that's good. So you have ETFs and mutual funds that are investing in emerging market fixed income going after that really hard. They're loving that. Now, all of a sudden, think about this. Those companies that issued dollar-denominated bonds from Turkey, how are they going to pay those back if their lira has dropped by 80% since the beginning of the year? Even if it dropped by 40% or 30%, think about how difficult that is to pay back a dollar-denominated bond. The cost of that is incredibly high. And this is why on Friday, S&P dropped their rating on Turkey's debt, the sovereign debt now, from BB to B+, which is clearly in the junk category. This happened after the close on Friday. Because there is a very clear understanding that the ability for any of these bonds to get paid back, particularly the ones that are in U.S. dollars, that were issued, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars around the world, maybe even trillions, of dollar-denominated bonds have been issued over the last 7 years, let's say, when there was an easy money policy and everything was kind of floating along and the insatiable appetite for investors seeking yield, this all came into play and created a monster. In that, if the U.S. dollar appreciated strongly against those other currencies over time, there's going to be a big backlash. So the big question now that people are asking with the Turkish lira down is, hey, what's the contagion factor? Is there the potential? And you've been starting to hear a little bit about this. The word contagion is starting to come out again. Emerging markets. Is there a contagion? Are we going to see like we saw back in the Latin America meltdown some years ago, or maybe what happened in the Asia currency meltdown a number of years ago? Are we going to see this contagion? And in fact, will that spread and impact here in the U.S. and other developed markets around the world? Now, of course, those bulls say, it's temporary, don't worry about it. And you have the bears that are just freaking out and saying, oh my God, short everything. But let's kind of look at really what's going on, because if you haven't been following it and if you're stuck in a cocoon a little bit, you would say, well, I don't know. Markets here seem to be okay. Bonds are kind of hanging around, doing not much. Stock market's up and down a little bit, some extra volatility, but generally speaking, still a couple percent off of the highs. That's not a big deal. So what's going on? Why? Where's the big concern? Well, the problem is that if you look at emerging markets, they're off about 20% from their highs, which we'll get to in a second. But the contagion factor has already started. And I think the lira is actually part of contagion that was started some time ago when we saw what was going on in Venezuela and Argentina. The Indian rupee, the Chinese yuan. The lira is just one more. Just one more in a series of currencies that are getting blasted. You know, you look at what's gone on with China's currency and, you know, it's at a relative high that we haven't seen in the last year and a half. Well, the U.S. dollar's at a high. The currency of China's at a low. You know, you look at what's gone on around the world with the fact that the Fed is tightening, pulling back on quantitative easing, talking a bit hawkish about the economic outlook and saying they can continue with their rate hike regime process. And what's happened is you're seeing the knock-on effects, or let's call it the contagion, from currencies around the world and countries around the world having a real difficult time keeping up with the fact that the dollar has been surging against their particular currency. And there's a lot of reasons why. Yeah, we could bring in the whole tariff issue and sanction issue, depending on what country it is. Look at what's gone on with Iran, with their currencies also in their markets. But also you have to look outside the U.S. If you look outside the U.S. for a second, you'll realize that while the U.S. is only a couple of percent off of their highs, what's happening with the rest of the world? And if you look at the markets around the world, and I have, let's see here. Just give me one second. I want to pull this because I saw. Yeah, here we go. Let me pull this out. If you look at the major markets around the world, for example, and you look at how the ETFs have performed, which is a really good way to look at this because it will combine pretty much the currency and the market and how it's performed in 2018. So the S&P 500 up 6.6%. The NASDAQ up 13.2%. Okay. Mexico up 1.1%. Canada down 2.3%. Brazil down 17.5%. The UK down 6%. France down 3%. Germany down 10%. South Africa, another problem with the currency that we saw recently. The Rand got obliterated last week. Down 24%. Russia down 6%. China small caps down 11%. China big caps down 10%. Hong Kong. The Hong Kong ETF down 5%. This is the equity ETFs, by the way, just to clarify. Down 5.9%. Australia is pretty much flat. South Korea down 13.9%. Japan down 4.6%. And Taiwan is marginally higher. So think about that for a second. The differential between the U.S. market performance, which we'll call the S&P 500 for a second here, okay? Up 6.6% year to date. And Germany down 10.9. That's a 16% differential. And remember, a number of episodes ago, we talked about how going into this year, all these institutional investors were just pumped and hyping and pushing the EM and non-US trade. They were looking at, well, the undervalued nature of these areas compared to the US. You need to be in a lighter position in the U.S. and overweight EM, emerging markets, and overweight non-U.S. Well, if you look at this just on the left side, I'm looking at a map of the world, a flat map, and you look at this, the left side, which consists of the U.S., Canada, Mexico, that was the place to be. Totally wrong call. The right side, which is where they said to be, is all down anywhere from 3% to 24% year to date. So somebody's got their wires crossed here a bit. Now, of course, they probably will come back if I ask them to come back. Oh, it's a better value now, which, by the way, I think is. I think some of the emerging markets are a better value now. And what we did was for those portfolios for clients that had an undervalue of emerging markets from our portfolio standpoint, we actually added back to that and brought them back up to the level that we wanted to have. We've been light for about, about a year or so. We've been lighter on emerging markets than we would normally be. We brought those levels back up last week to the levels that we would normally have, not an overweight, but a neutral weight for emerging markets. So we were underweight for about a year or so. All this has gone on and happened, and the valuation levels that I see now seem to be much better, obviously. You know, if we see something down 20%, valuations are better. That doesn't mean we're going to see a quick turnaround tomorrow. But I think longer term, if some of this trade issues can resolve a bit, and the reality is that if we see the tariffs tamp down ever so slightly, some of the rhetoric about other sanctions, and also if we see the Fed slow down on their entire rate hiking process just ever so slightly, which I think they will do, by the way. I think they'll have the next rate hike, which now is expected to be September. I think that will go in. I think that 25 basis point rate hike is going to happen. However, the December rate hike, I think that they're going to hold off, actually. I think what's going to happen is you're going to see the consumer sentiment slip a little bit, which we're going to talk about in a second, what happened this week. I think that you're going to see that manufacturing is going to slow, exports are going to slow, and GDP is going to roll over. Now, that it may or may not hit around November, December, because we'll be a little bit early for this. But I do think that they're going to see this pull forward effect, which we've been talking about on a regular basis, where a lot of the exports and a lot of consumer expenditures were done because they wanted to get ahead of the higher prices that were probably going to be implemented on, very soon with these tariffs that were going to be imposed, pushed GDP up to 4.1%. And somewhere in the next couple quarters, and it's hard to get an exact number because we have rolling implementation periods and dates for when the tariffs will be implemented. But if you think about it, if people got ahead of it and tried to bulk up and bring up their inventories, buy things ahead of the price increases, on the other side, there's a vacuum. So I think the Fed is going to be well aware of this. It's going to become very clear when manufacturing numbers come out over the next few months, and in particular, towards the fourth quarter. So again, I think the contagion has happened, and I think the product of some of the contagion is the rand, the South African rand, and is the lira. And I think that there is a long way to go before some of this resolves, by the way. And the resolution will be what took the Dow Jones up 400 points on Thursday, which is the potential for a resolution of some of these trade wars. Because the trade wars and the tariffs are really punishing those countries that we are pushing against. And that's the goal, right? The goal is to punish them until let's call it what it is, right? We're strong-arming them. If you don't do what we want you to do, we're going to punish you. And you're going to feel an incredible amount of pain because we're a lot stronger. And once that pain hits, if you still don't agree with us and do what we want, we're going to put our shoe right on your throat. And we're going to press harder. I mean, that's what's going on. Whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, that's what's going on. So right now, we have to watch to see exactly what happens. Now, on Thursday, we did see this commentary. Again, why did the Dow Jones drop at the beginning of the week? There's all this flurry of concern over the continuation of trade wars and China slowing down, which they had some numbers that were a little bit weak. Some of their reported earnings on companies, both in U.S. and abroad, were a little bit weaker. Markets said, okay, we're not really interested in this whole thing right now. And then all of a sudden, we saw on Thursday, there was some talk that lower level meetings have been set. Lower level. What? I don't know what that is. It's a lower level meeting. So in other words, the diplomats and the trade ministers from various countries are not going to be attending. It's going to be, the lower level. couple of visitors from each place that have some kind of authority, probably not binding authority in any way, will get together. Now, what's going to be the result? You know the result. Let's not kid around. We know what's going on. They're going to get together next week. I think at the end of next week. And why next week? Why is it next week? Why all of a sudden do we have this happening? Why do we see that this announcement happened that on the 21st and 22nd of August, there's going to be these lower level meetings that are going to be set to restart trade talks with China? Why all of a sudden? Because on the 23rd, the second set of tariffs will go into effect. The $16 billion worth of goods that are going to be tariffed, and I think it's 25%, are going into effect. So if, in fact, we can get ahead of this on the 21st and 22nd, and we have nice meetings, and then out of that meeting comes some really good thumbs up. Yes, we've made progress. As a matter of fact, you know you're going to see the word, we have a framework, whatever that means, back to that framework. Always look for that word. Framework is a governmental word that says they've really have gotten nothing done. They're going to continue on talking and to hopefully get something done. And they use the word framework to make it look like something actually is happening. In each industry, in each area of the markets, there's key words that you have to watch for. The framework is the governmental word that's used for anything that has been discussed with no resolution, and they're just going to have to discuss it further in the future. But their intent is to allow for the markets to believe that something's being done. All right, call me crazy, but that's what I think this is all about. But here's the problem. While the markets rejoiced and moved up 400 points on Thursday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average in particular, because it's very sensitive to these trade issues, the companies that are involved inside the Dow. The fact is that I don't believe that China or the U.S. are willing to really give up on their strongman tactics, either side. Both sides have been saying, hey, we're going to implement this. And the other side says, well, you do that, we're going to come back with an equal and equivalent or maybe even a harder hitting tariff on the other side. Okay, you're going to do that, we're going to then go higher. You know, you're going to higher? Okay, well, we're going to hit back with this with the same number. However, each side is also very concerned about their equity markets. We know very clearly from this administration that we have in place right now, they are very concerned and they watch it all the time. The equity markets are paramount to what they believe is their success of what they're doing. They manage their process according to what's going on with the equity markets. If the equity markets do well, they believe, well, that must be something we should continue doing. If they don't, they'll come out, talk about a different thing. And Larry Kudlow comes out on Friday and dances around and talks about how, yes, we have not only a meeting set up, but we have an outline that we've created about what we're going to do. What happened? You know, with this roadmap that they developed, a draft. They have a draft of a roadmap of an outline. It's not a framework yet. It's a draft of a roadmap of an outline. That moved up the Dow by another 100 points, hoping that, you know, somehow we're going to get some resolution here. Now, again, the strategic timing of when this is all happening on the 21st, 22nd of August, ahead of the 23rd deadline for implementation of the tariffs against China, is very important. And I believe probably if I know what I've seen before with this administration, particularly, they do not want this to go into effect. They got the first ones into effect and they see, wow, that's really hurt a lot of our areas. We see what's going on with Harley-Davidson and Whirlpool. We see what's happening with aluminum prices and steel prices. We see what's happening with consumer confidence based on this. I mean, maybe what we want to do is continue our threats, but we don't want to actually put these into place. What's going to happen on the 21st and 22nd, I would bet probably, is going to be that they're going to come out of this with a discussion about a framework and say, we are not going to implement these tariffs. We're going to postpone them to, let's say, September 22nd, give it another 30 days for a cooling off period, for a discussion period, in order to get the higher level discussions going on with President Trump and President Xi. That would seem likely of how this administration operates. So are you a betting man or woman? Well, yeah, you're in the stock market, so you got to figure out and play the odds. So the odds are that these tariffs are going to be postponed. How is that going to be seen by the markets? Well, we know already that the Dow Jones jumped 400 points just on the thought that lower level meetings have been set up to restart trade talks. 400 points on that bit of nonsense. Now, whether or not this is going to be a sell the news type of event, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news, I think there's a lot of people that are holding back their investments because they're very concerned about what is the outcome of these tariffs on the actual bottom line of companies and the cost factors, inflation, et cetera. So I would be looking to next week very carefully on how this all plays out and what happens ahead of this, and would not be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised with anything. With what's gone on, with the tweets, with all the craziness that's gone on, I would not be surprised with any outcome, by the way. Whether or not we double up or take it off the table entirely. Either of those would not surprise me. But I think the probability is that they're going to come out of this meeting with some exaggerated comments on major accomplishments that have been made with nothing to back it up. Somehow a framework is going to be discussed. Somebody keep track of this for me, will you? I'll try to remember too, but keep track if the result of these meetings, the word framework comes up. And if it does, reply to me on Twitter. My handle is Andrew Horowitz. Email me, I don't know, somehow remind me, tell me. So put it on your calendar for the 21st, 22nd. Look for the word framework out of the low-level meetings with China. I mentioned that the University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Index came out on Friday, and it dipped a little. It was for the preliminary for August. It dipped to 95, well, it came in at 95.3. Expectations were for 97. Why? Why is there some kind of a little bit of slippage here on the confidence reports? And what's happening? It looks like the key takeaway from the report is that there was the big part of the reduction in confidence came from the fact that there is much higher prices on large household durables. People are having a hard time justifying paying these high prices for refrigerators or washing machines, dishwashers, whatever those large durables on the household are. Prices have gone up. We know that. We know that with all of the tariffs that we've seen, we know that with all of the things that we've seen with the currencies, and we've seen the back and forth here, prices have escalated dramatically. And that's causing some problems. Said another way, people are concerned about inflation on their household goods. That is what is causing a dip in confidence. And by the way, we've talked about this before many times. Tariffs are inflationary. Think about it. And if you don't agree with me, I don't understand it. The very nature of increasing prices on goods that are imported, and if that is the case, the domestic products, the companies are going to increase their prices also because they can. And what did I just say? Increasing prices is inflationary. It's the basic definition of inflation. Increasing prices. That makes sense, right? So people are very concerned about the fact that prices are going up. We've seen that this is an issue across many lines, but in particular because the prices of many of the durable goods are attached to the first tariffs that were put into place way back on washers and dryers, et cetera. This is causing a bit of a stir now. So there's a bit of a delay in how long it takes to get into the market and eventually hit the consumer. and now it's hitting. So this delay is starting to hit in with inflationary pressures on durable goods. We'll see what happens with cars. We'll see what happens with other companies that have been hit with tariffs on any of the input and manufacturing side of things and how they're going to pass it on. Because they're going to pass it on. You don't think that this is going to absorb it, do you? They're going to pass on as much as possible. All right, let's move on to, this is a topic that I don't even know where to begin or end with this, but it's just an ongoing, fascinating, fascinating topic. And that's Tesla. Tesla. You've been following. You know that I've been pretty bearish on the stock for a while. And I mentioned that to you a number of weeks ago that I'm really concerned about the ability for this company to maintain any kind of level of production that will make it profitable. Even if they boost production of the Model 3 to 6,000 cars per week, the problem is the company is still burning through an amazing amount of cash on a quarterly basis and has yet to turn profitable. Now, with Elon Musk doing some crazy things, at least in my opinion, trying to hit back on products from suppliers from previous products that were bought by Tesla and trying to get price reductions, laying off all sorts of people, laying off all sorts of consultants, trying his best to figure out ways to bring money into the company, whether it's, through better production or cutting staff, cutting costs. The problem is that there's also been some talk about a real collapse in the interest for Model 3s. A lot of people asking for their money back. A lot fewer people making reservations. And even so, if in fact he got through all the reservations, there's no way to really tell unless there's some really interesting accounting that will be done in order to maintain, in order to get to profitability. Now, he's promised profitability in third or fourth quarter, somewhere around there. So far, he's relatively been okay on some of his projections and when certain things will happen, like, do anything you have to do in order to get those 5,000 cars per week off the assembly line. He did it by setting up tents, working 24/7. Who knows about what else was done to get to that level? But now he wants to be profitable. Puts out this tweet last week. That tweet, or the week before. And I got to tell you something. The fact that things are getting weirder by the day is telling us something. Don't go deaf to what is right in front of us here. These tweets and what's gone on, they're getting stranger and stranger. They're going down a weird street here. He talks about, in this tweet, taking the company private. Hey, I'm going to take the company private at $4.20 a share and funding secured. Wow. If you haven't been tracking this, think about what he just said in this tweet. That he's looking to take the company private at $420. He puts a price tag on it, okay? Looking to take the company private. And I got the funding. That's what he said. Funding secured. Problem is, everybody's wondering, where's this funding coming from and how in hell are you going to try to do some kind of a privatization of this company? Or, go private deal, which usually requires a company that's undervalued, has a lot of free cash flow, and a lot less debt. Tesla has an enormous amount of debt. They have negative cash flow, no profitability, and he's looking to get a higher price than it's currently at. And the price is high to begin with, or it was at the time when he talked about it. Stock ramped up 10% on this tweet. They halted it for a couple of hours, started trading again, came back a little bit. Then anybody starts scratching their head. Wait a second. Where's this funding coming from? Then speculation. Well, maybe it's the Saudis. Maybe the Saudis, they have like a 5% position. Maybe they're going to invest a lot more. Probably not. They have a big position in GM as their autonomous driving and possibly electric vehicle choice. Well, maybe it's going to come from somewhere else. Where else? And again, why would anybody do this with the information that we know to be true about the company structure and debt and equity and all of the cash flow and all that? Why would anybody do this? Now the company and the board are trying to cover their tracks because the SEC is now looking into this possibility of fraud going on here. You know, what was the impetus of the tweet? Was it try once again to squeeze the shorts, which he did? Was it for some other nefarious reasons? I don't know. But what we do know right now is that there's very little information coming out as to what was really the whole backup of the funding secured comment. I mean, clearly he said funding secured. If you read that in black and white, like, oh, wow, this deal's going through. This private deal is probably going through. He's got the funding. I mean, why would you think anything otherwise, right? So now the company and the board are trying to cover their tracks. They're hiring lawyers individually. And it looks like they're in much deeper problems here than were imagined. I got to tell you something. Now, on the other side, you may be a big Elon Musk fan, which, okay, that's great. He's a brilliant guy. No question about that. Maybe it's his brilliance is somewhere hidden here. Maybe Musk is trying to somehow bring down the stock. This is all designed to bring down the stock price, to buy more and then squeeze the shorts again. I don't think so. It's going to be interesting to see what happens here in terms of how the SEC responds to this whole funding issue. And if funding was not secured, how are they going to be responding? And are they going to fine the company? They're just going to say, oh, bad boy, don't do that again. You have to have some concrete information. I mean, there's a lot of different implications about this. If, in fact, the SEC just slaps them on the wrist and says, oh, bad boy, that can't do that again. Do you realize what other CEOs can do in public and social media type of venues to try to pump up their stock? They're in a, you know, it's different if you or I said something, oh, I really like this stock, I'm buying it, I think it's going to go to 420. Totally different than the CEO of the company and founder saying, oh, we're going to, you know, looks like we're going private. And I'd like to do so, and I think you're getting at 420 and we got funding. It's a whole different animal. So you look at this, there is something very wrong with this whole structure and what's gone on here. I'd like to keep an eye on this. Now, the stock is down about 70 or 80 points from where it launched to right after that tweet. So obviously there's a lot more to meet the eye on this whole thing. Keep an eye on Tesla because there's going to be a lot of implications on what actually happens with the board and the SEC. All right, a couple other things I want to mention here. I think if you hadn't had the opportunity to listen to last week's podcast and the week before's podcast, I think they were spectacular guests. If you hadn't had the chance to do it, make sure to download those last two podcasts in particular. We had the last week with Chris DeRose. We talked about cryptocurrencies, but more importantly, a lot of the psychology that's around it. It was really this philosophical discussion about the mindset of the cryptocurrency buyer, trader, market, and what's going on there. Fascinating discussion. We went a lot of different directions there, I got to tell you, but it was great. And then before that, the week before that, we had a doc from Berkeley. And he was on talking about CRISPR and this cutting-edge biotech, mind-blowing stuff when it comes to this CRISPR technology. Something you really have to, you know, take a look at. And also mentioned DH Unplugged. Each and every week, John C. Dvorak, myself, Tuesday nights, 9 o'clock. Or you can download it from wherever you find your podcasts. And finally, on the cleaning up information topic, we had some more updates and upgrades to Investology. I'm not sure if I mentioned this also, but, you know, I got it right here. We finally got the Investology trademarked. We got it registered and trademarked. So there you go. Kind of cool. But you got to go check out the site, this great risk and portfolio modeling engine that we have on there over on Investology. That's E-N, VESTOLOGY.com. Go on that site, click on the top where it says client login. You just register for free and then create portfolios. You see how you score from a risk and time horizon level and see how the portfolio is modeled around that. And then once you have your portfolio set, you can follow the bouncing ball to open an account and fund. Very, very easy process. And we take it from there. We do regular rebalancing, watching and managing the investment and the investments within the portfolio. Really cool stuff. Investology.com. Check it out. And now, let's get to some listener questions that I think were really good. You can always ask me a question over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew button there at the top and just ask away and we'll try to get to it. Either I'll send you an email back or I'll answer it. We got a couple of questions I thought were really interesting here that I wanted to pick up on because I think that could be something that a lot of you may also have similar questions with. So this question is from Mark Johnson. And Mark writes, he says, I listen to both podcasts, which is, of course, DH Unplugged and this one, Disciplined Investor. He says, what's my food Instagram you'd like to follow? Well, for all of you that want to follow my foodie Instagram feed, it's Dad Bod Food Blog. And he says, could you please break down with an example of a value trader, technical trader, and a fundamental trader to the same stock? Thanks, Mark. You know what, Mark, I'm going to do, I believe that these answers are actually a good part of the guts of my first book that I wrote called The Disciplined Investor. Hey, there you go. That's how we got the name of the podcast, by the way. I'm going to send you that book. So Mark Johnson, if you're listening, email me, send me, go to Ask Andrew, whatever. Send me your address and I'm going to send you a copy of that book because I think it's going to answer that because we have in that book, there are chapters on quantitative investing and fundamentals and what to look for and technical analysis and a lot of other things. By the way, you can get that on an audiobook over at Amazon. But I'm going to send you that book. So Mark, that will answer your question. This one comes from Jay Golden. He says, just came across your podcast and already really enjoying it. Hey, thank you. He says, my question is, what is going to happen to the bond market in the U.S. fiscal year 2019? I'm listening to David Stockman. He points out that quantitative easing is not just the interest rates that is to worry about. QT. Yeah, I think that's what he's talking. Yeah, I guess the quantitative easing. But the $600 billion a year pulling out from the markets. Add that to the U.S. borrowing an additional $1.2 trillion to pay for the expanded budget and tax cuts. Okay, I don't exactly know what David Stockman is talking about with regard to 2019, but obviously one of the things and themes that we've been talking about here for some time is make sure that your bond exposure is on the short side of the spectrum. Maturities, duration, because you have a skew problem that's going on. SKEW. Skew is when you see that if there is an extraneous event that there could be a significant move on the other side by a security. And the securities we're talking about here are fixed income. The longer term ones have more of a potential for a movement, in my opinion, with interest rates spiking up, if we see that. Now, of course, that the Fed is really working on the short term side of the, right? They're dealing on the left. So if the 6-month treasury bill is on the left, and the 30-year is on the right, they're working on the left-hand side. They're looking at the Fed funds rates, right? That's kind of short-term, very short-term. They're pushing those up. But still, you have much less of a reaction. It's kind of like a fulcrum. There's much less of a reaction on the shorter side of the bond spectrum right now. And those are still doing pretty well compared to, let's say, the longer side. However, all that being the case, I agree with the fact that there is this big problem we have here with the fact that we put this massive tax cut in. The Republicans are spending like crazy, like not Republicans, they're spending like super duper, incredibly spendaholic Democrats. Right? That's what the Republicans would call this kind of spending. this administration and this current Congress are spending without restraint. I don't think anybody could disagree with that. The hope is that it will pump up the economy, it'll bring in more taxes, and that is going to offset all this. The hope. We've yet to see that, but that's the hope. 2019, I still think we're going to see a continuation of the same thing that we're seeing, a slow grind. I think the Fed's very aware of what's going on. They don't want to upset the whole process. They don't want this all to erupt either. And again, the canary in the coal mine, though, is what we talked about earlier, which is the whole idea that currencies are seeing major collapses. That's clearly the canary in the coal mine here. So I agree with the fact that we have this massive amount of taxes that have to be paid that are not being paid or that may be paid. I agree with the fact that there's a lot of tightening going on aside from interest rates because the quantitative easing is slowing down and they're letting it roll off. And that's exactly why we're seeing all these problems with emerging markets around the world. Liquidity is a big part of how they operate, and liquidity has been constrained. And that's why I agree with the fact you want to keep your bond exposure very short in your portfolio. I'm not sure if that answered that question, but I hope it did. Let's see here. This one comes from Gary Kelsey. He says, what are some of the basics of REITs? Is there a good time or a bad time to invest in REITs? And how are they different from other stocks? So REITs are real estate investment trusts, REIT, real estate investment trusts. And essentially, real estate investment trusts, like the name suggests, invest in real estate. They're kind of similar to mutual funds in a lot of ways in structure. And I grabbed a couple of the highlights that probably you want to look at here. So let me just read these off and rattle these off to you. That so a REIT is a company that must meet these following requirements to maintain their qualification as a REIT. So they have to be taxable as a corporation, have to be managed by a board of trustees, invest at least 75% of their total assets in real estate, cash, or U.S. treasuries. They have to pay a minimum of 90% of their taxable income in the form of shareholder dividends each year. So they have to pretty much pay out all the income. They have to have no more than 50% of its shares held by five or fewer individuals, have a minimum of 100 shareholders, be managed by a board of directors, trustees. I said that. Let's see what else is there. Receive a minimum 75% of its gross income from rents from real estate, interest on mortgages, financed real mortgages financing real property, or from sales of real estate. So basically, it's all about real estate, right? You could buy them on the open market. When's a good time? Well, a lot of these are, some of them are leveraged, some of these are equity, some of these are non-leveraged, some of these are commercial real estate, some are very defined. There's different types of REITs. They all have different categories. But if you think about it for a second, you really want to buy REITs in a lower interest rate environment when people are searching for yield. As yields are coming up, REITs have been hurt. So the REIT market gets hurt in an increasing interest rate environment. Over time, when we plateau with rates and we level off, they'll probably be a good place for them again. We like REITs. I mean, I think there's a place for them, international and domestic, in a portfolio for diversification. You know, picking up a few percent of REITs inside of a portfolio, I think, does help to provide some diversification against equities, commodities, domestic, international, et cetera. So, and bonds. I think it gives you that extra added diversification. Again, if you want to ask me a question, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew button there. But thank you, everybody, for these good questions. I answered a lot of them by emails already also. And that's going to pretty much wrap it up. I don't know if there's anything else that we're covering today. I think we covered a lot, actually. So it's going to wrap it up for this week. We'll be back next week, and I hope you will be too. Make sure to tell your friends. Do me a favor, retweet this when it comes out, throw it up on Facebook, send it out to your friends. Hey, there's a great podcast. You know, talk it up a little bit. Talk it up. Get it out there. I think it's important that we share good things with our friends and family and people we care about. Again, I'm Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.